Let's begin today's reading of the Boston Globe on the Talking Information Center as our newspaper coverage continues on this Monday, the 24th of August, 2026. With today's Boston Globe reading, we say hello to Grant and Susan.
Good morning. Thank you, John. I'm going to start things off in the Globe's business page. This has been submitted by Kara Miller. Sham peer reviews and harassment. Challenges abound for women doctors. Dr. Paula Muto has been in medicine for more than 30 years, and she has seen woman after woman pushed out of medical leadership. They've had their performance questioned, their leadership styles doubted, and even their appearances put under a microscope. Quote, even women's physicians who've risen to as high as CEO have not survived it, end quote, Muto, a North Andover-based surgeon, notes. For years, research has shown that female doctors frequently experience bullying and discrimination, and which can make securing and staying in medical leadership roles particularly difficult. As of 2023, women accounted for over half, 55% of U.S. medical students and 45% of medical student and school faculty members, but only 25% of department chairs, according to a 2025 article in JAMA Network Open. A 2024 article in the same journal found that, compared with men, women in medical school, deans, reported having to work harder to advance while receiving less support and opportunities for leadership positions by their own institutions. Muto recalls that about a decade ago, a surgeon arrived in town who targeted a well-loved female chief of surgery. He saw her case volume and wanted it. What came next, said Muto, was a sham peer review, a practice in which a colleague falsely accuses a doctor of misconduct on the job. As a colleague, Muto reviewed the cases in which the chief of surgery was accused of a breach in the standard of care. She said she found there was none. She just happened to be on call for a couple of complicated patients. But the ordeal was too much for the chief of surgery, and she resigned and then eventually left medicine. Muto once considered becoming chief of surgery at a hospital. When she met resistance from leadership, she started a company instead. Suddenly, she found herself at conferences with other female doctors. Quote, I started to talk to women, and we started to share our stories, and everyone had the exact same story, end quote. When the women spoke, she said they talked about everything from sexual harassment to personal harassment to sham peer reviews. And then you realized, oh my God, this problem is national. None of this surprises Sarah Temkin, a surgeon and the director of the documentary 1001 Cuts about challenges facing female surgeons. Temkin once served as a hospital division director in charge of gynecological oncology. But she said, even though I had a title, I called it responsibility without authority. Temkin said that women commonly raise safety concerns, but they are often not listened to. Both peers and mentors advised her to get a man to raise important issues in the hospital. Being a healthcare leader who lacks authority is a terrible position to be in because you're responsible for people's lives, said Temkin. Temkin emphasizes that it's not just men who view men as natural leaders. She has witnessed women bullying other women, but she said talking about it can be taboo. Dr. Clara Keegan, a family doctor and associate professor at the University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine, notes that more women than men are becoming doctors, but there is definitely a gap both in compensation and in positions in academic leadership, she said. As you move up the leadership, the percentage that are women becomes smaller and smaller. Keegan notes that on-chair searches that I've been on, one of the things on the rubric that we're supposed to evaluate people on is their chair presence, and I think that that is the sort of place where a bias can come in. In part, that's because men are often viewed as better or more natural leaders. A 2019 study by researchers at Washington University found that healthcare professionals and surgeons hold implicit and explicit biases associating men with careers in surgery and women with family and family medicine. Many female physicians believe they are targeted for the sort of assertiveness that would be admired in a man, or at least tolerated. Dr. Pringle Miller, founder of the advocacy group Physician Just Equality, which provides peer support to physicians, frequently works with doctors, particularly women, who fear for their livelihoods because of sham peer reviews. Doctors from across the country turn to Miller's organization, and the mistreatment that Miller sees takes a variety of forms, she said, including bullying, harassment, discrimination, retaliation, and it's pervasive. But there are other issues. Temkin believes that sexual harassment is ubiquitous, and for women on the path to leadership, it's another way that women have their confidence undermined, or it can force women to simply change jobs. When Temkin herself was sexually harassed by an operating room technician who leered and made inappropriate comments, she said she wasn't sure what to do. Quote, you don't know if you should report it or not, because you don't know if it's going to affect patient care. You don't know if it's going to affect your own career, end quote. As women gain more power, Temkin believes that the nature of the discrimination they experience changes. The sexual harassment and some of the little digs may be worse while women are younger. But as women gain expertise and rise into leadership positions, they're much more likely to experience frank discrimination, which limits their ability to be successful in their leadership position. Many women end up quitting, resulting in enormous losses for patients, said Miller. She notes that female doctors often have a superior result. A 2023 JAMA article found that patients of female surgeons were less likely to die, be readmitted, or have major complications after surgery. She argues that it hurts medical outcomes when women are pushed out or leave because of mistreatment. In 2015, one physician who asked that some identifying details remain anonymous because of potential repercussions was the chief of anesthesiology at a community hospital in Massachusetts. She had held the position for about 7 years until her boss approached her one day. Quote, the administration doesn't like your facial expression, she remembers him saying. You're going to have to step down. She was shocked. She believed that a man would never have been talked to that way. Before she immigrated to the United States from Europe, the physician said, I had this vision of America, or the thought of America, that it's amazing and everything is fair. But being a woman in medical leadership proved more complicated than she had anticipated. Quote, there are more women going into medicine than men for the first time in history, end quote, noted the anesthesiologist. So if you discourage or mistreat that woman physician, they're going to give up. They're going to go part-time. They're going to retire early, and then society loses. It's important for the healthcare system to take this issue seriously. In 1970, when fewer than 8% of doctors were women, losing a substantial number of them didn't significantly alter the workforce. But now, Temkin said, if women make up 50% of the physician workforce, and we're forcing out 20% of them because of these issues related to culture and the way that we treat women, then that becomes a real systems problem. It is the increase in the number of female doctors that makes the bullying and harassment of women in medicine particularly concerning, with ramifications for the environment within hospitals, the quality of care administered, and the doctors available to administer it. Fixing the problem will require attention from leaders in academic medicine, professional organizations, hospitals, and government. It's a problem that will not solve itself, and that should not depend on women risking their careers to tell their stories. Over to you, Grant.
Thank you, Susan. This next option for power rate comes with volatility. As Massachusetts looks into ways to cut bills, New Hampshire's troubles could provide lesson. Article here by Hiawatha Bray. As Massachusetts politicians scramble to respond to public anger over high electric bills, they are reviewing a different way for utilities to purchase electric power, one that had benefited some buyers but is under fire in neighboring New Hampshire. Instead of utilities buying all their electricity months in advance, as in the current setup, the proposal would require them to purchase at least some power on the spot market, where prices can fluctuate from day to day. part of broader efforts to rein in utility bills that are among the highest in the nation. The spot market proposal has gained currency after a recent report asserting power generating companies are charging excessive prices for advance purchase contracts. It's a concept that's worked well for the city government of Boston, which for the past decade has bought all its electricity on the spot market, claiming about $60 million in savings as a result. But spot buying has been a bust so far in New Hampshire, which just announced rate increases because surging gas prices earlier this year led to a spike in electricity bought on the spot market. That isn't discouraging regulators in the state of Connecticut to cut from giving the spot market a try. The state passed a law last year that requires utilities to purchase at least 25% of their electricity in that manner. Each approach has its risks for utilities and their customers. Spot markets are more volatile as severe winter or summer weather or geopolitical events such as the war with Iran can send prices on wild swings. Conversely, a period of extended calm, both in nature and in politics, can keep spot prices below what utilities agreed to pay in advance in the advance purchase contracts earlier if they buy in that manner. The spot market experiments are an object lesson in the limited options available to regulators trying to manage rising energy bills. States that deregulated their electric supply markets in the 1990s, including Massachusetts and New Hampshire, relinquished control over the whole electric system, limiting their oversight to the utilities that deliver the power, not the independent companies that generate it. The purchase cost of that electricity is passed directly onto end users at no profit to utilities. And power generators, said Donald Kreiss, New Hampshire's consumer advocate, have little incentive to keep prices in check. These are big, profit-maximizing firms with very aggressive promises to their shareholders, Kreiss said. I think that the system of regulation has failed to aggressively defend consumer interests. And so the economic actors who are trying to make money for shareholders have been taking advantage of that. Mandating spot market purchases offers state officials a rare opportunity to exert leverage over electric prices. But as New Hampshire's experience shows, the policy is not without risk. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey is demanding action in the wake of a report from Synapse Energy Economics that found that between 2014 and 2025, Massachusetts customers on basic service paid $3.4 billion more for electricity than it cost to produce that power over that period. It's unacceptable that customers are left paying billions of dollars in additional costs because of the way the current system is set up, said Healey. The energy affordability bill under debate on Beacon Hill suggests utilities should cut power costs by purchasing some electricity the day before they need it. The legislation calls for the state's Department of Public Utilities to consider adopting such a plan. Utilities would purchase the power through a spot market overseen by ISO New England, the agency that manages the region's electrical grid. in New Hampshire, the three major utilities, Eversource, Unitil, and Liberty, buy half of their estimated power needs 6 months in advance, the rest from the spot market. If spot prices fall below the contract price, customers could get a rate reduction during the next six-month period. But spot market prices go up as well as down. Eversource spokesman William Hinkle noted the higher spot prices in New Hampshire were driven by multiple impactful and relatively unpredictable events, including a global conflict in Iran and one of the coldest winters New England's seen in a decade plus. Henry Herndon, executive director of the Community Power Coalition of New Hampshire, estimated the spot market spikes cost Eversource customers, that is, a total of $38 million plus interest. So as of August 1st, the average New Hampshire residential customer will pay as much as $18 more each month for electric power. Basically, today's customers are paying for yesterday's bad bets, said Kreis, who represents the interests of residential electric customers before the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, or PUC. That's bad for consumers. The New Hampshire PUC declined to comment on regulatory matters outside of public hearings. A spokesperson for Constellation Energy, a major power plant operator serving Massachusetts, emphasized the risk of buying power on the spot market. Competitive bidding for default service protects consumers from market volatility by securing energy at predictable prices, the spokesperson said. Spot market purchases offer no such protection, leaving customers exposed to fluctuations in energy costs. But Pat Knight, director of analysis at Synapse, said Massachusetts regulators should not shy away from the spot market simply because of occasional price spikes. No one is ever going to exactly know the future energy price, said Knight. But by setting an estimate in charging or dispersing ratepayers the difference, you achieve low prices over the long term. Knight points to Illinois, where utilities are required to buy part of their power on the spot market. Knight said Illinois ratepayers have experienced both rate hikes and reductions due to gyrations in the spot markets. Knight favors an approach that combines spot market purchases with a new state agency that would negotiate power contracts with generating companies to achieve lower prices. He estimates such a system would have saved Massachusetts consumers $1.8 billion between 2015 and 2024. For now, the spot pricing plan would directly affect a minority of consumers. Synapse estimates 27% of Massachusetts residents have so-called default or basic electrical service that would be subject to the plan. The rest purchase electricity from independent suppliers or through municipal aggregation pools, but 27% accounts to nearly 700,000 households, said Knight. And if it works, other electricity sellers may be pressured to lower their prices as well. Brian Sweat, chief climate officer for the city of Boston, noted that the city's municipal aggregation program, Boston Community Choice Electricity, saved $60 million over the past decade by purchasing power for the city's own buildings and streetlights on the spot market instead of paying the standard Eversource rate. The program also offers cut-rate power to Boston residents by negotiating lower six-month rates than what Eversource offers. But Sweat isn't convinced that switching to spot purchases makes sense for everyone in Boston. Taking on that risk on behalf of hundreds of thousands of residential households and guaranteeing them a fixed price is a totally different level of complexity, Sweat said. The current trend in utility bills is a reminder that the 35 states that deregulated electric service haven't experienced the economic benefits they expected. In the 1980s, deregulation of airline and telephone markets led to cheaper phone calls and airfares. Economists and politicians expected the same from electricity deregulation. But the local utility remains a monopoly, in part because of the extensive work required to install and run all the necessary wires and substations in a given city. And their side of the electric bill has soared in recent years as well. Meanwhile, competition in the power markets has not yielded huge savings. Several economic studies show that in deregulated states, consumers pay more than those in regulated states, $40 a month more, according to a 2023 survey conducted by the New York Times. Again, that article by Hiawatha Bray of the Globe staff. Susan.
Thanks, Grant. We move now to an article submitted by Ian Austin with the New York Times. Trump's new 50% tariffs on Canada target goods from wood to clothing out of Ottawa. Anoraks and suit jackets, national flags, some Christmas ornaments, and 36 different kinds of plywood. The lists of hundreds of goods from Canada subject to new 50% tariffs from the United States are long and seemingly organized at random. The Trump administration imposed the tariffs, which took effect Saturday, after Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney called off trade negotiations with the United States that they had lasted nearly a month. They asked for too much and offered too little, Carney said. Carney has promised to retaliate dollar for dollar against the new tariffs, which join previous tariffs of up to 50% that President Trump put on Canadian aluminum, steel, and autos last year. Lumber has tariffs that predate Trump's return to office. He nevertheless increased them last year. Here are some of the goods that are subject to the new tariffs. For Canadian companies that depend on U.S. business, the new tariffs are likely to be a source of great anxiety. For customs brokers and trade lawyers who guide those companies, they are an extraordinary business opportunity. But for the lay reader, the tariffs are sometimes baffling. The items affected, according to the Trump administration, cover $20 billion in Canadian exports, and they are laid out in three lists. Some clear patterns emerge from the text. Canada's forest industry, which has been enmeshed in seemingly endless battle with the United States for decades, has been particularly targeted. On the lists, the many wood products, including 36 different kinds of plywood alone. Home builders in the United States have already said there is not enough U.S. product to replace the Canadian plywood, so the tariffs could increase housing construction costs. Alcohol is also prominent. The Trump administration has been particularly vexed by the fact that 8 of Canada's 10 provinces still restrict United States wines and spirits from their government-owned liquor distribution system and stores. Those measures began after Trump suggested making Canada the 51st state and imposed tariffs in violation of the free trade agreement between the two countries and Mexico. Some of the drinks, now effectively shut out from the United States by tariffs, hold little obvious appeal, including mixtures of or with a basis of odoriferous substances with 20 to 50% alcohol by weight, requiring only the addition of ethyl alcohol or water to be a beverage. Left unexplained is why anyone would add more alcohol to something that is already half composed of the intoxicant. Dairy products are another target. Canada uses production quotas and other tools to protect domestic dairy producers who sell largely to the Canadian market, potentially limiting the effect of the new U.S. duties. Clothing and textiles also take a hit. Like the United States, much of Canada's clothing production moved overseas long ago, and some Canadian online retailers sell goods made abroad to United States customers. That, however, will not give them an out. Simply shipping things from Canada triggers the tariffs, regardless of where the products were made. Few items of clothing escape the tariffs. They include overcoats, anoraks, windbreakers, sleeveless jackets, cotton sweaters, t-shirts, car coats, capes, cloaks, tracksuits, suit jackets, blazers, and dresses. Gloves, mittens, and mitts are on the list unless they are related to sports. Also included are national flags, canvas used for painting, stage backdrops, tarpaulins, awnings, and sunblinds. Not every item on the list comes from large companies. Several products, including jewelry and honey, come from small, even one-person operations. The item descriptions range from the broad to the almost peculiarly specific. Among the latter is wood furniture, of a kind used in the bedroom and not designed for motor vehicle use. The tariff list has a bit of a spoil sport bent by including, quote, articles for Christmas festivities, ornaments, not of glass or wood, end quote, toys, including riding ones, but not bikes, fishing rods, hockey sticks, skates, and festive, carnival, or other entertainment articles. Dog owners will also see similar increases in the prices of leashes, collars, muzzles, and harnesses. Above all, the list reveals intriguing hidden sides of Canadian industry, including companies that produce or sell bookbinding machines, egg grading equipment, marine buoys, derricks, sand and steam blasters, stills, not for domestic purposes, safes, and base metal statuettes. Back to you, Grant.
Thank you, Susan. This data center backlash burst into midterms. The article here, Shane Goldmacher crafted. Here are the details. The fight over data centers is suddenly at the epicenter of the midterm elections. One new ad in Texas begins with someone typing into a chatbot, "Why is my electric bill going up?" Another in Ohio blames one of the state's Republican senators for a proliferation of data centers, calling them a total scam. And in top House battlegrounds in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, the Democratic challengers are all running ads against the server warehouses powering the artificial intelligence boom. Data centers have become a quickly emerging fault line in the broader fight over an AI revolution that is remaking the global economy and threatening to disrupt the job market. Now politicians are racing to tap into the backlash or inoculate themselves as political strategists in both parties describe the issue as an unusually fast-moving force that is already reshaping races for the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansions. It's very much a bottom-up organic movement, said Anna Greenberg, a veteran Democratic pollster, who said that while people's views on data centers were largely tied to how close they lived to them, the facilities were also becoming symbols of the excesses of Silicon Valley. Data centers are a physical manifestation, she said. Billionaires are building them, and it feeds into all of the big tech skepticism that is there. It's very symbolic of everybody's issues with AI. There are signs that the emerging data center debate is scrambling the usual partisan divisions. So far, Democrats have chiefly been the ones racing to harness voter anger about data centers over rising electricity prices, water use, and mistrust of the tech sector. They aim to punish Republicans for cozying up to industry by approving many of these projects. Some Republicans are now using data center as an epithet and casting themselves as the real opponents of corporate tax breaks and unfettered construction. Last week, Mike Rogers, the Republican nominee for Senate in the key swing state of Michigan, said that he supports a one-year moratorium on data center construction. Polls show a revolt brewing against data centers. A Gallup poll conducted in March showed 71% opposed local construction of the centers. In a summer survey from the Annenberg Public Policy Center of the University of Pennsylvania showed that the number of people opposing new data centers in their areas had risen by 12 percentage points since February and March of this year. Susan.
Thank you. We move now to an article submitted by Globe staff reporter Tonya Alanez. New Hampshire cold case unit seeks lead in the 1977 death. New photos of White Mountains hiker released. On the 49th anniversary of the killing of a New Hampshire woman who went missing while hiking in the White Mountains National Forest, law enforcement released previously undisclosed photos of Shari Roth in hopes of sparking memories and generating new leads in the cold case, according to state officials. New Hampshire's cold case unit is making a plea for local residents or hikers who may have seen the 22-year-old when she was en route from her home in North Conway to Sawyer Pond near Livermore to come forward. Investigators are also seeking the owner of a red Volkswagen Bug that was parked at the Sawyer Pond Trail on August 21st of 1977, the day Roth set out for a solo hike. Roth was a social worker who worked with the elderly, battered women, and troubled teens. She also was a nature lover and outdoor enthusiast. Her nude and strangled body was found 3 days after she disappeared, just off the trail, midway to the pond. Roth's family has maintained a website devoted to solving her murder and is offering a $25,000 reward. Shari was a gentle flower just waiting for the sunrise, the family said in a statement released by the New Hampshire Attorney General, John M. Formella. She lived by the words, "You can't change the world, but you can change your corner," the family statement said. "All we can ask is that if someone reads this and has information about who killed her, please come forward. Change your corner of the world by doing the right thing. Your information could help bring answers, justice, and a resolution to our family and friends who love and miss her every day." Roth grew up in Massachusetts and graduated from Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School. She studied at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and graduated from Syracuse University before settling in New Hampshire. The three photos released by authorities show Roth happy in nature. In one, she is surrounded by evergreen trees. Beaming ear to ear, she digs in a knapsack. In another, she stands elevated above the skyline, squinting into the sunlight. She wears a flannel shirt with a red sweater tied around her waist. In the third image, Roth poses on a rock slab, her feet in the water, a red-brimmed sun hat atop her short, light brown hair. Shari was a dedicated social worker with a bright future who was simply enjoying the natural beauty of our state when her life was violently taken, Senior Assistant Attorney General R. Christopher Knowles, Chief of the Cold Case Unit, said in a statement. "By releasing these previously unseen photographs, we're asking the public to look closely," Knowles said. "We hope these images might jog the memory of a hiker, a local resident, or a visitor who was in the North Conway or Livermore areas in August of 1977. Even the smallest detail could be the key to solving this case. In particular, investigators would like to hear from hikers on the Sawyerbrook Trail or visitors to the Livermore, Bartlett, or Lincoln areas during the weekend of August 24th, 1977. They would also like to speak with people who lived or worked in the North Conway area in the summer of 1977, or who recall seeing Roth or noticed anything unusual. The owners of the red VW bug parked at the trailhead are not suspects, law enforcement officials said, but investigators believe that they may have helpful information. Investigators are also interested in reviewing any personal hiking logs or journals kept by hikers who were in the vicinity of the Sawyer Pond Trail or Mount Carrigane in late August of 1977. No detail is too small to be relevant, Formella's office said. Investigators urge anyone with information about Roth's disappearance and murder to call the Cold Case Unit tip line at 603-271-2663. Or email coldcaseunit@dos.nh.gov. Tips can be submitted online at www.doj.nh.gov/criminal/cold case. Next to you, Grant.
Susan, this world's breadbaskets pounded by war, weather, trade spats, global supply of wheat in danger. This article by Samini Sengupta. Instant noodles, sliced bread, wheat is at the heart of the modern diet, and this year it is facing an accumulation of modern dangers. The breadbaskets of the world are getting pummeled by drone strikes and devilish weather, nudging prices higher amid already soaring food costs in the wake of the Iran war. Heat and drought have diminished harvest in some of the biggest wheat-producing countries, including the United States, which is expected to have its worst wheat harvest in half a century, spiking prices. Poor countries that agreed to buy American wheat under the threat of Trump's tariffs could be stuck paying abnormally high prices. The Black Sea, a crucial passage for the global wheat market, is an active theater of the Russia-Ukraine war, while the Houthi militias' attacks on shipping in the Red Sea have already forced grain shipments to take a longer, more expensive route around South Africa. Beyond that, a supercharged El Nino further threatens water levels in the Panama Canal, while drought has reduced water levels to perilously low levels in transit routes like the Rhine and Danube rivers in Europe, raising transportation costs. All this at a time when the global atmosphere is hotter than normal because of a century of fossil fuel burning, threatening the livelihoods of small farmers. The simultaneous troubles reveal the risk inherent in the global food system today. Only a few crops, like wheat, provide most of the world's calories. Relatively few governments dominate the export of wheat, including Russia, Canada, and the United States, as well as Ukraine and the European Union. Their customers are mainly low-income countries that no longer grow much of the food their people eat. The system we currently have in place depends on three things: seamless trade, cheap energy, and a stable climate, said Evan Fraser, a professor who studies the global food system at the University of Guelph in Ontario. Today, it seems none of these assumptions are met. Few things are as politically potent as the price of bread, and wheat prices were already at a three-year high in July, this according to the Food and Agricultural Organization, the United Nations agency has warned of higher prices later this year. The saving grace is that the world had a bumper crop of wheat last year, and global stocks remain strong. The risk, said Monica Todhova, an economist who specializes in commodities at the Food and Agricultural Organization, is that several sources of uncertainty begin to reinforce one another. A combination of El Nino-related weather impacts across major exporters, renewed constraints on Black Sea exports, and further disruptions to key shipping routes would have implications far beyond wheat production itself, she said. Russia and Ukraine together account for nearly a third of the wheat that the world buys. This year, just as harvest began, their grain shipments have nearly ground to a halt. In recent weeks, Russia and Ukraine have stepped up their attacks at each other's grain export terminals and ships in the Black Sea, a waterway they share to get their goods out to the world. Wildfires this summer spared the wheat belt of France, the EU's largest wheat producer, but the heat has not. France expects lower yields because of record heat this summer, according to government projections. Germany's main farmers group said Tuesday that yields were down for several crops, including grain, because of drought and heat. In July, the European Trade Group for Agricultural Commodities, COSERAL, issued a special bulletin estimating lower grain yields of approximately 315 million tons this year, compared with the 341 million tons in 2025 for the continent and also Britain. Australia, also a major wheat exporter, planted fewer acres of wheat because of high fertilizer costs stemming from the Strait of Hormuz closure. The U.S. is about to have its worst wheat harvest since 1970, largely because of a terrible drought in the Great Plains. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimated in its latest report this month that will occur. American farmers had devoted fewer acres to wheat, and yields per acre were also down. Rising prices of imported wheat put enormous pressure on governments that are forced to buy high and then help subsidize the cost to keep bread prices within the reach of their people. Then there are President Trump's tariffs. To try to avoid additional higher rates, some wheat importing emerging economies such as Bangladesh agreed to buy substantial amounts of U.S. wheat. That means they are obliged to pay whatever price U.S. wheat goes for this year, even if it is substantially higher than what other countries are offering. Analysts in Bangladesh have denounced the deal as unfair. The perils facing the world's breadbaskets come at a time when an El Nino, a naturally recurring weather pattern, is raising the risks of extreme weather for farmers in many parts of the world. The last major El Nino event in 2015 and 2016 worsened food insecurity for an estimated 60 to 100 million people, the World Food Program estimated. This time, the World Food Program says it could expand the ranks of those who are unable to meet their daily food needs to 274 million, up from 225 million today. It is naive to think we can rely on a food system built for a different era, Frazier said. Susan.
Thank you. I'm going to move to the Metro section. This article was submitted by Globe staff reporter Tonya Alanez. Scammers cost Massachusetts victims $24 million, FBI says. Callers pose as Boston Division special agents. The FBI is warning the public about an agent impersonation scam that more than 1,000 New Englanders fell victim to last year, resulting in nearly $29 million in losses, according to a statement issued by the agency. Of those victims, 706 were in Massachusetts, where they reported losing $24,508,041, a spokesperson for the agency's Boston division said. Nationwide, 32,424 victims filed complaints with losses totaling more than $797 million, the FBI said. Quote, scammers are utilizing fear, urgency, and increasingly sophisticated tactics, including spoofing trusted phone numbers, to push people into acting before they can think it through, end quote, Ted E. Dock, special agent in charge of the FBI's Boston division, said in a statement issued last week. The scam begins when someone, posing as a representative from a bank or some other financial institution, calls and tells the victim that their information has been used to open an account that was used to buy illegal guns, the FBI said. The caller transfers the victim to someone claiming to be an FBI special agent who is investigating the fraud. The victim is then encouraged to verify the number, at which point the call inexplicably disconnects, according to the FBI's advisory. A return call displaying the FBI's main Boston number of 857-386-2000 follows. The alleged agent, with a fake name and badge number, encourages the victim to move the conversation to a confidential messaging application. The victim is then told that the communications with the FBI are confidential and not to tell anyone about it, the agency spokesperson said. Federal officials warn the public to be vigilant and know that the FBI will never call or email private citizens to demand payment, personal information, threaten arrest, or ask you to communicate via an encrypted application. Quote, if you get an unexpected call from someone claiming to be the FBI or any law enforcement agency, stop, hang up, then verify the caller by contacting the organization directly using a number that you found yourself, Docs said. That pause can shut down a scam and keep criminals from turning your panic into their payday. The FBI did not detail how the scammers flipped the calls into fraudulent financial gains, but said it cost 1,092 people in Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island $28,895,404 in the year of 2025. Those are the New England states covered by the FBI's Boston division, which reported the following breakdowns for each of the states. There were 125 victims in Maine reporting losses, $684,587. 706 victims in Massachusetts reported losses, $24,508,041. 148 victims in New Hampshire reporting losses at $1,678,840. 113 victims in Rhode Island reporting losses of $2,023,936. The FBI said the fraudsters in government impersonation fraud collect money by threatening to extort victims with physical or financial harm in order to obtain social security numbers, credit card or bank information, money, or access to a computer or a phone. Similar scams are conducted via email, the FBI said. Such interactions should be reported to the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center at ic3.gov or to the FBI Boston Division at 857-386-2000. Grant?
Susan, this article. More towns drop flock cameras. Grafton and East Bridgewater cite public backlash. Article Camilo Fonseca authored here. Two more Massachusetts communities are terminating their contracts with Flock Safety, the controversial license plate reader system that has raised concerns about privacy. The Grafton and East Bridgewater Police Departments announced in social media posts Friday that they would cut ties with the company. More than a dozen municipalities in Massachusetts have publicly suspended or terminated use of the cameras in recent months. Both departments cited community backlash as the driving force behind the decision. Grafton Police Chief Neil A. Minardi said in a statement that the department had begun deactivating the cameras amid growing concerns about the use of this technology in our community. This decision also comes in response to vandalism and theft involving these devices, Minardi said. Grafton Police previously announced the installation of 12 of the cameras. At the time, officials sought to allay public concerns by saying the cameras did not use facial recognition technology and that every use must be tied to a legitimate law enforcement purpose. East Bridgewater originally planned to install 4 Flock cameras, but police said that only one had been brought online before the project was paused for public review. On Friday, the department announced that it would terminate its contract and work with Flock to remove the camera already installed. The department cited the concerns raised locally and nationally about privacy, data access, oversight, safeguards, and the potential for misuse. East Bridgewater Police Chief Michael Jenkins described the decision as a matter of community trust. As chief of police, I have a responsibility to continually evaluate whether technology remains appropriate for our department and our community, Jenks said in a statement. That responsibility does not end once a contract has been signed. Jenkins said that automated license readers are still useful in law as a law enforcement tool when properly governed. But he added the ongoing concerns surrounding the program outweigh the benefits we anticipated receiving from it. There will be times when new technology provides significant benefits to law enforcement, Jenkins said. There will also be times when we determine that the risks, concerns, or lack of political confidence warrant taking a different approach. Responsible leadership means being willing to reassess decisions when circumstances change. That is what we are doing here. East Bridgewater Police said they had not identified any misuse of the Flock system or its data by any officers or town employee. Flock surveillance cameras have been installed in over 100 communities in Massachusetts, but they have raised concerns of misuse by law enforcement due in part to questionable searches targeting private citizens. Earlier this week, police in Stowe announced they would also cut ties with Flock, the direct result of an officer who allegedly used the camera system in other state databases to access a person's personal information. The officer in question allegedly targeted a former partner who told Boston 25 News that she had left an abusive relationship with him. New Bedford police also said they would pause the use of their Flock cameras after an officer was accused of stalking her ex-girlfriend was placed on leave. New Bedford Police Chief Jason Thody said officials would conduct a thorough review of the technology and how to best ensure its secure use going forward. Susan.
Thank you. I'm going to move now to an article submitted by Malcolm Gay on Globestaff. BSO Musicians Management Closer to Deal. Ratification vote called pending in contract talks. And what seems a clear sign of progress in contract negotiations between musicians and management at the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the BSO announced on Sunday that a ratification vote is now in the offing. Details were scarce, but the parties have agreed to a 48-hour extension of their current labor agreement. The musicians' contract previously was set to expire late Sunday night. It will now conclude at 11:59 p.m. on Tuesday. In an email announcing the contract extension, the BSO's president, Chad Smith, said a ratification vote is pending, adding he would provide more details in the coming days. Members of the Boston Symphony Players Committee, which is representing musicians in negotiations, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The two sides have been far apart when they entered tense marathon negotiations over the weekend. Pressure appeared to mount on Saturday when the musicians voted to authorize a strike, a negotiating tactic that clears the way for a work stoppage if the parties fail to reach an agreement. The negotiations have taken place against a backdrop of profound crisis at the BSO, which remains deeply divided over management's brusque dismissal of music director Andras Nelson's. The players, many of whom were deeply committed to Nelson's, remained furious that they weren't consulted on the decision, saying they fear top-down future at the BSO, where artistic decision-making resides in the C-suite. Management, meanwhile, has sought to move on, saying that the organization must adapt to meet daunting fiscal and demographic challenges. That's all the time that we have for today. Once again, thank you very much for listening to the live reading of the Boston Globe. I'm Susan.
I'm Grant. Thank you. Weatherman says we have some good weather ahead over the next 3 days, then some showers late in the week with humidity returning, but summer is still with us. Enjoy. Thank you for your ongoing support of the Talking Information Center.